I now call upon our brother Jim Cowley to address us to the subject, "Then Cease the Work of the House of Yahweh."
We have come, I think, to the end of chapter 3 in our studies thus far. I think we nearly got to the end of chapter 3 last time. And we found there that division had arisen in the ecclesia of God in those times. A division which, on the surface of it, brethren and sisters, would not appear to have been very serious. But in time it proved to be disastrous. Each of our studies in the book of Ezra is designed to have one, at least, one leading principle which we want to circulate around for the entire session. And tonight is no different. Tonight we want to circulate around the principle of the need to have a largeness of view of things, to see the wider view of issues, to see things from a divine perspective and not with the short-sightedness to which we are so prone. And I think just a few moments of self-examination will demonstrate the truth of the fact that we are, as human beings, despite the fact that we've got the truth, we are very short-sighted. It's manifested in a number of ways. Someone might say something that is perhaps somewhat unkind about us. It's a tendency for us to take the short-sighted view, to become quite disturbed at the comments that are made about us, rather than taking the long view. The long view, as the Lord said, was to pray for that individual might realise their need not to say derogatory things about others. The large view looks to the end of the matter. It seeks to repair the damage that might have been done with a few hasty words. The short term, the short-sighted view of things feels hurt pride and will probably attempt either to in some way repay the unkindness or perhaps to completely back off from the individual who may have been guilty of such derogatory words. I think all of us have been through that experience at times. We all perhaps know something about ecclesial difficulties. And one thing that I have learned over the years, many of you also will have experienced, that if you take the short-term view of issues in the ecclesia, you are skating on very thin ice. So tonight we want to focus upon that particular principle, the need to look down the corridor to see issues for what they are and where they might lead, and to take the appropriate action now to deal with those issues. If the ancient men of chapter 3 and verse 12 had taken that view, brethren and sisters, they would not have done what they did. They would not have scarred the minds of the younger people in the way that they did by weeping on the occasion, the joyous occasion of the laying of that foundation. We considered that, didn't we, in verse 12. The teachers and the leaders of that nation, the priests, the Levites and the chief fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house and all its glory, had been there to see that place that Solomon had built, in which was found the ark and all the other pieces of furniture, in which they of course placed great store. And now they were building a temple that, though it was over double the size of Solomon's temple, it lacked the glory. It had none of the glory. It didn't have the ark, it didn't have the lampstand, it didn't have all the things that first temple had. And so they wept. It says that they wept with a loud voice and in competition with those who shouted for joy, as the noise of one side grew with their cries of joy and rejoicing, so they were matched on the other side by the cries of howling and weeping on the part of the ancient men. So that we read in verse 13 that the people could not discern, they could not make a difference between the noise of the shout of the joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. If you were there witnessing those events, you would have been confused. You wouldn't have been able to decide who was making the most noise, the weepers or those who were shouting for joy. But of course, tomorrow was a new day. The weepers would have ceased weeping on the next day. And you could have argued, taking the short-term view, that what those ancient men had done had not left any debris, any legacy in its wake. But that was not the case, brethren and sisters. There was a great legacy left in the wake of those events, there were consequences that were to last for the next 15 years. And that, of course, demonstrates the lack of wisdom and the lack of foresight upon the part of those ancient men. If they'd had the facility of looking down the corridor of time and seeing the impact of their behaviour upon their brethren and sisters, they would have been a little bit more cautious in their approach on that day. And I would submit to you that we've all got something to learn in that regard. Every single one of us, doesn't matter how long you've been in the truth, we've all got something to learn. These were the ancient men. They didn't understand the principle of the need to take a largeness of view, to see the end from the beginning, as the Father does. And he acts on that basis because he knows the end from the beginning. That's the quality we've got to try and produce in ourselves. And the blunting of the enthusiasm of the younger people was to have enormous consequences in the time to come. For when the pressure came on and the adversaries arrived, brethren and sisters, and when the going got difficult, and when it became very difficult to labour in the ecclesia, when it wasn't a comfortable job at all, that's when people started to give up. That's when people remembered the weeping of the ancient men. That's when the blunting of enthusiasm began to tell. It was years down the track for many. But it was in that, in many cases, it was that particular event that was the last straw that broke the camel's back. If the ancient men couldn't see any purpose in what they were doing, then why should the younger ones labour? That was the argument that they would have produced. And eventually, we read at the end of chapter 4, through various circumstances, in verse 24, then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. And that, of course, is our title for this evening. Why did it cease? Well, it ceased, as I said, for a number of reasons, but one of them was the short-sightedness of the leaders of the ecclesia. Had they not tried to match the noise of the rejoicing with the noise of their weeping, it may never have happened. And so we come to chapter 4 and verse 1. Immediately after, and probably because of the rejoicing and the weeping, the adversaries arrive. Read in verse 1 of chapter 4, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto Yahweh God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers. These are the ones of verse 12 of chapter 3, remember. These are the ones whose spirit was broken. And immediately the challenge came. Isn't it just like that in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters? Isn't it like that when we take a despondent view or a depressed view of something, that Yahweh immediately brings a challenge to us and opposition comes along to see what we're made of, to make us realise that we have made a mistake, to make us go back, to reconsider our position? And so immediately the challenge comes from the adversaries. The word adversaries, as you'll see from the notes that we've given you, zar means narrow, from the idea of a tight place, a constricting place. Hence, an opponent as one who crowds you in. And there were adversaries all around them. There were peoples who inhabited that land who had filled the vacuum when the nation of Judah was taken into captivity some 70 years before. And they had come and they had lived in the towns and villages around Jerusalem. Jerusalem itself, of course, was a scrap heap. No one could live there. But around that city there were little villages where these peoples had come and settled. And they, of course, were very jealous about their newfound home. They didn't like the idea of these people coming back and rebuilding Jerusalem. So they began their challenge, and it went on, this opposition, for 15 years. Until finally it was laid to rest in the second year of the reign of Darius Hystaspes. So we read in verse 2, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as ye do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria or Assyria, which brought us up hither. You know, there's something else that we need to learn from that verse, quite apart from the challenge to the elders of the nation of Israel. It is this, brethren and sisters, that the challenge that comes from the world around us and sometimes from within is always in the guise of good. It's a fact of life, isn't it, that we are rarely approached by a problem that does not present itself in the guise of virtue or goodness. In the guise of one who desires to help and who has evil in his heart. I've been in the truth for some 20 odd years. I've been involved in ecclesial life as long as perhaps most of us here, in the area of trying to guide ecclesias in the way they ought to go. You know, brethren and sisters, in all that time I have never, ever struck a challenge to the way that we were attempting to go that has not presented itself in that guise. Never. It has never, ever been any other way. And you know, it's not going to change. And that's the lesson we've got to learn from this. I will look at two passages of Scripture in a moment which underline this point. But here in this chapter, what we've got is the Samaritan peoples who are enumerated for us down in verses 7 to 10. You see them there named in verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of their companions. They were the names of men who some 13 years later made representation to the king of Persia to stop the work. But they came from the nations enumerated in verses 9 and 10. Then wrote Rehum the chancellor and Shimshai the scribe and the rest of their companions, the Dinaites, the Apharsathites, not easy names, are they? The Tarpelites, the Apharsites, the Archivites, the Babylonians, the Susankites, the Dehavites, and the Elamites. They were the peoples involved in this challenge to the people of Judah. They were Samaritans, as they are delineated for us in verse 10, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Asnapper, that is an Assyrian king, brought over and set in the cities of Samaria. See, they're delineated as being Samaritans. And others who had settled in that region as a result of Assyrian conquest and deportation. It was the practice of the Assyrians to take people out of one land and to deposit them into another. And to take people out of that land and to bring them back into the position where they had just taken the others from. So they swapped them over. And this forced migration, of course, allowed the Assyrians to dominate those peoples because they were disoriented in a different land. They were therefore easy to make vassals and to keep them as vassals. So the Assyrians had brought these strange peoples from the whole of the then known world and deposited them in the land, mainly in the northern area of Israel where the 10 tribes had been, and they settled in and around the city of Samaria, which had of course been Ahab's capital. So we call them generally Samaritans. They were a mixed up bunch, as we shall see a bit later on when we come to the 2 Kings chapter 17. Mixed up both in their nationality and in their worship. These were the people who came along and challenged the Jews. They didn't challenge them by saying, look, what do you think you're doing? We're going to destroy your work. We are in opposition to what you're doing. They didn't present it that way. They said to them, let us build with you. But their true motive was to destroy. The proverb speaks of them, 26 of Proverbs and verses 23 to 26. These are the sort of people they were. Proverbs chapter 26. Verse 23. Burning lips and a wicked heart are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips. In other words, he's hypocritical. He hates in his heart, but he talks another language. Talks the language of friendship. So it says at the end of verse 24, and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart, whose hatred is covered by deceit. His wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Who will show it before the whole congregation? Who will demonstrate that these people are lying when they come along with an offer of help and claim to be their brethren? You see what they say back in Ezra chapter 4 and verse 2? Let us build with you, for we seek your God. We really serve Yahweh, your God, as ye do. They were claiming to be in the truth. They were claiming to have origins based upon the same as the men of Judah, that is, servants of Yahweh, of long standing. Because they then say in verse 2, and we do sacrifice unto him, unto Yahweh, since the days of Esarhaddon, who was the king who brought them up. So you see, brothers and sisters, they were saying, you've got no right to keep us out of this work because we are your brethren, we are Christadelphians. Who is going to demonstrate before the whole congregation that they're lying or that they haven't got it quite right? Only those who are perceptive. Only those who know, one, the background of that situation, the real truth concerning the fundamentals of their beliefs, and where it will lead if you make some sort of alliance with them. It's only those who've got the largeness of view, who can see the end and the beginning, that will understand the need to contend earnestly for the faith. There are many who have been sucked in. You might say to me, it doesn't happen here in Adelaide. We'd never be sucked in by those who claim to be Christadelphians, but who don't have the bona fides. We'd always be able to perceive their lack of qualifications. Well, it may be so, brethren and sisters, in this city, but it's not so everywhere in the brotherhood. I have seen a church, a Christadelphian hall called a church, built with the money of Catholics and another religion to boot. A Christadelphian hall, like the one we're building, built with Catholic money. And the basis was an equality in that project. Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. We've got the same fundamental beliefs, have they? Well, those Christadelphians didn't discern that. And out of that sort of activity, brethren and sisters, in England has grown the Endeavour Group. We don't hear a lot about that here. You hear a lot about it in England. The Endeavour Group is a group of Christadelphians who believe we ought to have unity with the churches. There are many Christadelphians in other countries and perhaps even in Australia who attend the memorial meeting in the Christadelphian Hall and go for their evening meeting to a church of another religion. And they see nothing wrong with that. In fact, they encourage that. And they are fighting within the brotherhood right now to establish that as a practice. We don't hear about that, do we? But it's happening. What happened to them was that they were approached by people like these Samaritans who claimed to have the same basic beliefs, and these people, these Christadelphians, could not see the issues. They didn't know their own fundamentals well enough, leave alone the fundamentals of the others, to be able to stand up and to contend earnestly for the faith. There are some brethren who spend half their life fighting battles like that. You and I live comfortably here in Australia, don't need to fight those issues just yet, but the day will come. Paul had a similar problem in Corinth. In the 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he was faced with people who had a different fundamental basis to their religion. Yet they were in the ecclesia. We dubbed them the Judaizers. They clung to the basis of Judaism and insisted that certain things were necessary for salvation, amongst which, of course, was circumcision. They would have it no other way. They challenged the apostle. They insinuated themselves into the ecclesia. And they were a very strong and viable force in it, as is testified by both the first and second epistles that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. When he comes to chapter 11, he terms those Judaizers in language that you and I would be reluctant to use, perhaps. In verse 13 of chapter 11 of the second epistle, he says, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel," he says, "for Satan himself." And the reason I quote this passage, brethren and sisters, is because shortly we're going to find that the adversaries of the Jews in Ezra chapter 4 and 5 are called by Zechariah Satan. Same basic fundamental problem. It was there in the brotherhood in the times of Ezra. It was there in the times of the Apostle Paul. It's here with us today. We need to be discerning. For no marvel, he says, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light, always in the guise of light, never in the guise of opposition. Therefore, it is of no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. They were a class of people who belonged to that ecclesia, and they were undermining at a furious rate the work of the apostle. And you know what, brothers and sisters? Within 100 years, they had succeeded. Within 100 years, nearly every ecclesia on the face of the earth had been corrupted, at least in part, many in total. Within 200 years, the Catholic Church was emerging. Within 300 years, there were no such thing as viable ecclesias in the Roman world. There were a few scattered pockets. And if they tried to manifest themselves as ecclesias, as you and I do, they were chased into oblivion. That's what came out of the lack of contending earnestly for the faith within the Corinthian ecclesia. You see, if we were there, we wouldn't have seen it that way, would we? Like the Corinthians, we wouldn't have seen it that way. Because unlike the Apostle Paul, who warned them that it would happen, we would not have a largeness of view. That's our problem. We do not see the end from the beginning. We are too narrow, too concerned with our own little interests, aren't we? We're concerned about what Brother so-and-so might say about us. We're concerned about whether or not people will come and talk to us at the meeting. Will we get enough attention in the meeting? We're not concerned with the larger issues as much as we ought to be. If we were, we'd have less concentration upon ourselves and more upon where the ecclesia was going. We would submerge ourselves for the sake of the ecclesial interest. It's that sort of largeness of view which was lacking in the times of Ezra and Joshua and Zerubbabel. Well, let's go back and have a look again at Ezra chapter 4 and that second verse, and see what happens when the invitation is given. Let us build with you, for we seek your God, as ye do. In verse 3 we read, but Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us to build an house unto our God. But we ourselves together will build unto Yahweh God of Israel. Now the words here are carefully chosen, brethren and sisters. They are not just chosen out of the air. Ye have nothing to do with us is literally translated by some, not for you and for us to build an house to our God. In other words, there were two distinct classes there. And the elders of Israel were saying, led by Zerubbabel and Joshua, particularly Joshua, as we'll find out in a moment, led by those two faithful men, one the high priest, the other the prince of the house of Judah, the governor, made it very plain that there could be no harmony, no symphony between light and darkness, between righteousness and unrighteousness, between truth and error. There could be no harmony. It is not for you, as one group, and for us as a separate group to build together the house of God. We are quite distinct. That was their answer. But we ourselves will build an house unto our God. You'll notice they say, but we ourselves together. And you know what, brothers and sisters? 13 years later, they weren't labouring together. That's the tragedy of it. They began together, you remember, in chapter 3, as one man came to Jerusalem. As one man. An Echad Ish, a mighty man. They ended 13 years later, every man building his own house. No one building the house of God. And for that 13 years, there was a dwindling off of the support for that work. Until finally, just a few labourers laboured, and even they were stopped by force and power. Yahweh permitted that because they were not working together. You see, there's a lesson here for us, isn't there? It won't take us, God willing, 15 years to build our hall. But as I've said before, brothers and sisters, it will take us longer than we think. And if you think everything's going to go right in the next 6 months, then you're not in command of what this book is all about. Because this book is all about how Yahweh places obstacles in the front of his people purposely to test their resolve, to see whether or not they really do want to get on with the work. He doesn't make it easy for them. He doesn't make it easy for us in life in building a spiritual house either, does he? He could, but he doesn't. And the reason is very simple, it's obvious. That we might be purified, that we might be tested, and that we might, brothers and sisters, exercise faith in the face of adversity and affliction. We don't like that, but that's his method. And so we read that they answered them in this way. But you'll notice at the end of verse 3, they say, "We will build a house unto Yahweh, God of Israel." In other words, they were defining who their God was. They used the covenant name of Exodus chapter 3, Yahweh, God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us. Now they could have said that we are building a house unto our God, as Cyrus hath commanded us, and as Yahweh our God would require of us. They could have put it the other way around, but they didn't. They said, "We are building the house of Yahweh, God of Israel," implying that he had commanded them to build it, "and of Cyrus, king of Persia." In other words, they were using the authority, first, of their God, and secondly, of the king of the day, who had given them the decree to proceed with that work. But that brings us to 2 Kings chapter 17. Because, you see, when they said Yahweh, God of Israel, that was an oblique reference to the origins of the people, the Samaritans, who were now attempting to insinuate themselves into that work. They were really telling them, obliquely, that they were not of Israel, though they claimed to be. That they were not servants of Yahweh, though they claimed to make offerings to him. In the 2 Kings chapter 17, we have the record of the overthrow of the northern kingdom of Israel and a summary of why it happened. In verse 24, we have the record of the way in which the king of Assyria settled the Samaritans, as they became known later, in the area of the northern tribes. And verse 24 says that he brought men from Babylon, from Cuthah, which was a province of Babylon, from Avar, a region of Assyria, from Hamath, which was north of Israel in Syria, and from Sepharvaim, which was also near Hamath to the north of Israel. And he placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. Now these are the people that later on the nation of Judah has to deal with. They have, by that time of course, changed in some way because of the fact that other peoples were brought in, and there was a crazy mixed up situation of nationalities in that area. But here were those that started off the process of developing the Samaritan race. The record tells us in the following verses they had a few problems. Yahweh sent lions amongst them, and they tried to find out why it was so that they should be afflicted by these lions. They concluded that they needed to understand the God of the land. They sent to the king, and he sent to them one of the priests of the northern kingdom. That is, a priest who knew nothing else but the worship of Jeroboam. So in verse 28 we read, "Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel." That's where Jeroboam's apostasy had begun. And you'll notice in your margin that repeated reference is made to the first of Kings chapter 12. You should note that because, of course, it's referring us to the fact that the origins of Jeroboam's religion were duplicated here in the establishment of the religion of the Samaritans. We read, "One of the priests came, and he dwelt in Bethel, and he taught them how they should fear Yahweh. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own, and put them in the houses of the high places." Notice the margin, 1 Kings 12, 31. "Jeroboam put his gods, his golden calves, in the houses of the high places which he had made for them, in Bethel and in Dan." They repeated that here in this chapter. Verse 30, "The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the booths of the daughters." That is, places of immoral behaviour. And so it goes on in the following verses to list off how these five races developed for themselves seven gods. But they also feared Yahweh, verse 32, "and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high places." Now it just so happens that the word "lowest" there is the same word that is used in 1 Kings 12:31 for Jeroboam's selection of priests. He selected priests from the whole range, or from the lowest of the people. Katsar is the Hebrew word. So they duplicated what Jeroboam had done. Of course, they were being taught by one of the priests that was carrying on his religion. So you see, when they came along in the days of Joshua and Zerubbabel and said, "We seek your God as ye do, and we make sacrifices unto him from the days of the time when the king of Assyria brought us up," they were talking about this chapter. And the elders of the Jews understood that, brothers and sisters. They knew, of course, from the scriptures, the history of those people. They knew their religion was not based upon truth. It was based upon the hideous apostasy of Jeroboam. And knowing that, they repudiated them. They contended earnestly for the faith, because they knew verse 34 was right. You see, though it says in verse 32 and 33 that they feared Yahweh and served their own gods, verse 34 is the correct summation. "And to this day they do after the former manners. They fear not Yahweh, neither do they after their statutes, or after their ordinances, or after the law and commandment which Yahweh commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel." That's what they're quoting from this chapter. "We are building a house unto the God of Israel." Chapter 17 of the 2nd of Kings tells us very plainly that they were facing a people whose origins were not in Israel, who did not serve Yahweh, the God of Israel, nor did they fear him, though they made offerings unto him. But of course, the ignorance in Israel in the times of Joshua and Zerubbabel would not have seen that with great clarity, brothers and sisters. They would not have seen the issues very clearly. And I wonder whether or not there would have been just a few people in the ecclesia of those days who would have said when they went home that night. Now, I think Joshua and Zerubbabel and the elders were a bit tough on these people. After all, they came along with an offer of help. It appeared to me to be very genuine. And they make sacrifices to Yahweh, and they have origins that go right back to those early days. Would have been some, perhaps, who would have thought that it was a bit tough to keep these people out. But not so the elders of the Jews. You know, this particular passage of scripture, brothers and sisters, is taken up elsewhere in the scriptures in a rather dramatic way. In the book of Zechariah, which of course is a commentary on Ezra 4 and 5, in many respects, especially on chapter 5, we have in Zechariah chapter 3 a very graphic picture of what occurred, firstly in Ezra chapter 4, in the initial approach of the Samaritans, then in their continuing opposition through the next 13 years until the work was stopped altogether, and then from the time when Haggai and Zechariah began to prophesy and the work began again in earnest and was completed in the year 516, over the next 4 years. Over that entire period, there was opposition from the Samaritans. But that particular period of time is graphically portrayed in a court scene in the book of Zechariah, in chapter 3. And what we find in that place is a picture which we've tried to illustrate here by setting out a court scene. And that's what we've got in Zechariah chapter 3, a graphic court scene. Let's read the first few verses of that chapter. "And he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of Yahweh, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him." When we come back in a moment to Ezra chapter 4, we're going to meet the Hebrew word sitnah, which comes from the root Hebrew word Satan. Satan is a Hebrew word. Satan, of course, has not been translated in verse 1 of Zechariah 3. It's been transliterated. Satan is a word that means to attack or to accuse. And here it is a reference, it's a personification, you might say, in one man, of the entire community of the Samaritans and other peoples who opposed the work of building the house of God from the year 535 BC, when they began that work, down to the year 516 and beyond, perhaps, when the work was completed in 516. That opposition, that general opposition, which eventually led to the cessation of the work in 522, is called Satan. They accused the Jews of doing that which would oppose the interest of the king. Hence they were accusers. Initially, of course, the attack was on the basis of an attempt to undermine the work by fifth column activity. But generally speaking, you can use one word for that entire period of opposition, the work of Satan. So we have this picture. What have we got? Well, we've got Joshua, the high priest, here in green, the representative of the nation who are standing behind him, along with Zerubbabel, the prince or the governor of the people. They are one party to this court scene. Joshua, being the high priest, is a representative man. He represents that people. We've got him standing before the angel of Yahweh. Now we're told in Jude verse 9 that the angel of Yahweh here was Michael the archangel. We'll look at Jude 9 in a moment. So he is there both as defense counsel in this court case and also as the judge. Michael the archangel was the only other individual in the universe apart from Yahweh and the Lord Jesus Christ who was ever given the right to forgive or condemn sin. He's the only other judge that had that divine right to forgive or condemn sin. You know that from Exodus 23, verses 20 to 23. So here he's representing Yahweh, who also is there as a defense counsel for the Jews. The witnesses are the angels. Now they're mentioned in verse 4. And he, that is the angel, Michael, answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, take away Joshua's filthy garments from him. They're also mentioned down in verse 7, at the end of the verse, when the promise is given to Joshua, I will give thee right of access to walk among these that stand by. Those who stand by are the angels. They are the witnesses in this court scene. So we've got Joshua, Michael and the angels and Satan in verse 1, who was standing at the right hand of Joshua to oppose him. He was there also with these other individuals because he was a representative man. You get the idea? Well, brothers and sisters, the fact of the matter is that though that court scene did occur, it did not occur in the way that Zechariah was shown here in his fourth night vision. It didn't occur that way. And that's the point that the scripture wants to make. If you were there, and we need to go back and stand there with Joshua and Zerubbabel and this community of people here, if you were there, all you would have seen with your eyes was the Satan. A large group of people headed up by a spokesman who over a period of time were accusing you of opposing the interests of the king, of attempting to establish a city of sedition that would rival the interests of the reigning king. That's all you would have seen. The angels were invisible. No one ever saw Michael, the archangel. He was invisible. And yet when Zechariah sees his night vision, he was shown Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of Yahweh. Zechariah saw the angel in that vision. He was shown Satan as one individual who stood there, when in fact he was a collective people that opposed the Jews over a long period of time. And he saw Joshua, representative, of course, of all the people of Israel. So you see, this was something that opened Zechariah's vision to the reality that they couldn't see with the literal eye. And it ought to tell us something, brothers and sisters, about our work and our labours in the truth, whether that be in building the spiritual house or in building a literal place of worship. The fact of the matter is that work is overshadowed by Yahweh. The opposition is there too, isn't it? We've got to deal with a recalcitrant council that makes Andrew's job very difficult. We've got to deal with engineers and others who don't seem to want to cooperate sometimes. We wonder sometimes whether or not those things are sent deliberately, and they are, that we might come to appreciate what Zechariah and those whom he would tell this to had to come to appreciate, that Yahweh was actually there all the time supporting them in that work. He was there through his angels overshadowing them. He was there to oppose the Satan. They couldn't see him with the literal eye. You know, there's a lesson to be learnt from this, brethren and sisters. First and foremost, it's the lesson of placing our trust in the unseen help of our God and believing that that's more real than the opposition that we receive. It's sometimes a bit difficult, but it can be done. And there's a second lesson, and we come to that in Zechariah 3 and verse 2. In Zechariah 3 and verse 2 we read, "And Yahweh, which is Michael the archangel, said unto Satan, Yahweh rebuke thee, O Satan, even Yahweh that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this Joshua and the people he represents a brand plucked out of the fire of Babylon? Haven't I taken them out of Babylon like a brand would be plucked out of a fire and brought them here and put them in this place and given them a decree through Cyrus to build this house? Yahweh rebuke thee," he said to the Samaritans. Did he? Well, I'll tell you, brethren and sisters, the Samaritans never heard a word from the mouth of Michael the archangel. Not one syllable. They never heard his voice. And nor did Joshua and the men of Israel. They never heard a word. And that's the point of it. The point very simply is this, brethren and sisters, that they had to see with the eye of faith and hear with the ear of faith those words. And there were two ways that Yahweh would rebuke the Samaritan opposition. He would do it by providential manipulation of events, which of course happened. And he would do it by the sterling contending for the faith of the men of Israel. And that's the point Jude wants to make. Have a look at Jude, verse 9. We all know what the epistle of Jude's about. He tells us in verse 3 what his epistle is all about. And in the course of that verse, he uses what has been termed the strongest word in the New Testament. You can't get any more intensely strong word than the word that he uses. In the third to last line of verse 3 of the epistle of Jude, it's got a prefix and a suffix. In fact, it's got a couple of suffixes. That's what makes it the strongest word in the New Testament. So we read in Jude 3, "Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, to talk about the fundamentals of our faith, it was needful for me to write unto you and to exhort you that you should earnestly contend," there's our word, it is the word epagonizephi, which is a word that can be broken down into English, to super agonize. To agonize with great intensity. "You should earnestly contend for the faith that was once delivered to the saints." They were not to do that by railing against the opposition, because that's not what Michael the archangel did. They were not to do that by rendering evil for evil or trying to shout down the opposition. They were to do it, brethren and sisters, by clinging to the nation, ungodly men who turned the grace of God into license. "We serve your God as you do. You can't keep us out of your ecclesia." And to those who cannot perceive the issues, it sounds a very forceful and logical reason to accept them. They crept in unawares. What does he say in verse 9? "Yet Michael the archangel, when contending with the Diabolos," the Satan, of Zechariah 3 and Ezra 4 and 5, He disputed about the body of Moses. The body of Moses was a description of the ecclesia of those times. They were in one man, remember? They were in Joshua the high priest, who acted according to the law of Moses. They were the body of Moses. He durst not bring against him a railing accusation, a blasphemia crisis, that is, a blasphemous judgment, but said, Yahweh rebuke thee. But no one ever heard a word from Michael. Yahweh was silent as far as audible words were concerned, brethren and sisters. And this is the point Jude wants to make. He's trying to tell these brethren that unless they contend for the faith with their voice, Yahweh can't contend except by providential means. He doesn't choose to speak aloud in this dispensation. He can use providential means. But unless we contend for the faith with our voice, brethren and sisters, he can't contend. That's how Yahweh said, Yahweh rebuke thee. He rebuked them through the words of the elders of Israel. Why do you think ecclesias go off the rails? Why do you think apostasy occurs? Well, I have had some time in a state where there is apostasy, and there's no question about it. People who blatantly teach doctrines that are subversive of the truth and are quite open about it, quite honest about it, many of them. Some are dishonest, others are honest about it. And yet they've been allowed to prosper and are still prospering in some ecclesias with whom we are in fellowship. And brethren and sisters, it could happen one day that we'll have a need to contend. I doubt very much whether or not many of us know very much about the fundamentals of what these people believe and why. Is it true? It'll be left to a few to contend earnestly for the faith. And if they don't contend, then the same would happen to us as has happened to many ecclesias. They're swept away in apostasy. It's happened before in history on numerous occasions. It could happen again if time was allowed. And the responsibility for us, brothers and sisters, is to take the largeness of view, to know the facts, the history, to know where it would end up if we didn't take the right action, to see in the largest of view the issues of the day, and to contend earnestly for the faith, though that will mean, in many cases, super agony. Not easy. Never has been easy. But it's the only way that Yahweh can say, Yahweh rebuke thee. So you see, when Zechariah picks this up, and when Jude picks it up at the end of the scriptures, they pick it up for a reason. To tell us that these events, way back here in Ezra chapter 4 and 5, where there were only, seemingly on the surface, two groups of people, is not the true story at all. In fact, brethren and sisters, there were three groups. There was Joshua and the Jews. There was Satan and the Samaritans. And there was Yahweh and his angels. And that, of course, made the difference between success and failure. So back in Ezra chapter 4, quickly now moving on to verses 4 to 6, we read, then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building. The word troubled, Hebrew bala, means to palpitate. Hence they terrified them. And that went on day in, day out. They terrified them by various means, and they hired counsellors against them to frustrate their purpose. Counsellors or advisers were those in the employ of the Persian government, the bureaucrats of the day. You know what it's like. If you happen to have the bureaucracy against you, they can make it very difficult, like they're making it for Gorbachev right now in Russia. So he's got to go for dictatorial executive power to overrule the bureaucracy. They can make it extremely difficult if they want it. They can make sure that pieces of paper don't go in the right direction, or if they do go in the right direction, that they haven't got the right thing written on them. They can make sure that the supplies that were ordered for the temple don't arrive. Oh, by mistake, they just didn't arrive. Someone else got them. And so they hired counsellors and advisers against them. They made sure that the public servants of the Persian Empire were bought off. And of course, we can't do that, can we? We can't bribe people to do the right thing, but the enemy can bribe them to do the wrong thing. How would you deal with that? Well, you've got to see that on your side you've got Michael the archangel and the angels that stand by, that it's Yahweh who's going to work against them. You've done your part. You've said Yahweh rebuke thee. Now let him do his part. So we read in verse 5 that they did this all the days of Cyrus king of Persia, which was for the next 7 or 8 years, even until the reign of Darius king of Persia. And we need to get a few of these kings sorted out in verses 5 through to 7. The Darius king of Persia of verse 5, as you can see from your notes, is a title. Darius means the restrainer or the maintainer, signified a king or a ruler. It's a reference in this verse to Darius Hystaspes, who's mentioned again in verse 24. So the opposition lasted from the days of Cyrus, who gave the decree in 536, right down to the times, in fact, the second year of Darius Hystaspes, or 520 BC. Now, I'll put this other chart on the screen for you, which may help you to see what we're talking about here. You can see on the left-hand side, we've got the decree of Cyrus in 536. And Cyrus reigned to about the year 529, when he died and was replaced by Cambyses, his son, who reigned for nearly eight years. Cambyses is mentioned in verse 6. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they, that is the Samaritans, unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. You remember how I mentioned that we'd meet the word sitnah? Well, the word accusation is that word. It means opposition. And the root of that Hebrew word is Satan, the word used in Zechariah chapter 3 and verse 1. So here they are. Here's the Satan that's opposing the work of building the house of God. What do? Well, they oppose the work from here right down to the end of the reign of Cyrus, who, of course, was sympathetic to that work. And when his son came to the throne, they thought, well, we'll try this man. Maybe he might be different than his father. So they wrote to Cambyses, the Ahasuerus of verse 6. Ahasuerus means the Lion King. Again, it's a title that was adopted by Cambyses. They all had titles in those days, some of them many titles. Well, there was no reply from Cambyses. There was silence for 7 years. Because, of course, he too was sympathetic to the work. You'll notice that this red block here, which begins in 535, the work on the temple, brothers and sisters, goes up and then gradually comes down. We'll demonstrate now, perhaps in our next study, God willing, what happened over that period of time. As in all ecclesial work, which starts well, it doesn't just collapse overnight. Have you ever seen an ecclesia collapse in one day? It doesn't happen that way, does it? There's all fervour and enthusiasm at the start. It's the same with our building project. There's fervour and enthusiasm. You wait and see if things start going wrong. A couple of years' time, if we still haven't got the place finished, you wait and see whether there's the same sort of fervour and enthusiasm. And if there is, then I will be very, very pleased. In fact, I'll be tickled pink, because we would have proven that human nature can sometimes behave differently than what it normally does. And if we can do that, that's great. Let's hope we don't have to wait 2 years to get our hall. But let's be prepared, brothers and sisters, for things not to go always right. You see, it didn't go that way for these people. It didn't go right. Things started to go wrong. Now, Yahweh could have made it different. He could have removed the opposition. By providential intervention, he could have upset the opposition of the Samaritans. He could have caused Cyrus or his son to come down and to remove them. He didn't. He left the opposition there deliberately. We'll explore the reason why in a moment. But the opposition went on, and the work began to fall behind, because things didn't turn up, materials didn't arrive, and the labourers got a bit tired of this. And they began to look at their own houses and say, well, I can't do anything here. may as well go and spend some time in my own house. And when the materials did arrive, well, you see, it was very difficult to come back from their own houses to begin building in the house of God. A few may have, a few wouldn't. They would cause others to be depressed, to lose heart. And so eventually the work dwindled away until finally there was just a few labourers left. And as I said before, they too were stopped by force and power. That's the way it always happens. Just a few left. You don't believe that? Open your eyes and look around at a few ecclesias. Always happens. Will it be different at Golden Grove, brothers and sisters? Will you and I be different? In a few years' time, when the gloss has gone off at all, and we've had a few tribulations, will we be different? Well, it's for you to make up your mind here and now that the lessons of this book are designed for us. Not for anybody else, they're designed for us. If the lesson is going to mean anything to us at all, it's got to mean this: that despite what adversity, what setbacks may come, despite what problems we may have amongst ourselves, whatever happens, brethren and sisters, you as an individual have to make up your mind that you will not be deterred from continuing with that work. It doesn't matter what happens, you'll go on with it. That's the decision that you've got to make. Are you going to be a stayer? Or do you think that this is just a short sprint? It's the marathon that's important, isn't it? It's the same with family life. It's the same with married life, brothers and sisters. You've got to see it with a largeness of view. You've got to look to the end of the process and accept the difficulties and the afflictions and the troubles and the problems along the way as being part of the process of development. If you can see the end, you'll endure that. If you can't see the end, you've got problems. Okay, that's what it's all about. Well, in verse 7 we read that after the silence of 7 years, Cambyses ruled for nearly 8 years. Total silence from him for 7 years. He was removed from the throne by violent means. In verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of their companions unto Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the writing of the letter was written in the Syrian tongue and interpreted in the Syrian tongue. And what we've done, as Brother Ronald read that for us, is we've read from verse 11 down to verse 16 the contents of the letter that they wrote to this king Artaxerxes in verse 7. And then in verses 17 to 22 we've read his reply. And then in verses 23 and 24 we have the consequences of his reply, and the work is brought to a grinding halt. Well, who was this Artaxerxes? We've had a Darius in verse 5, which is a title. We've had an Ahasuerus in verse 6, another title, referring to different kings. Now we've got an Artaxerxes. It's a title again, as you can see from the notes. It means powerful king. It was adopted by a man called Gamates, one of the Magi, an elitist group amongst the Persians, who thought that they should have been the ruling class. In fact, that they were a religious group who thought that they should dominate that empire. The Magi, the wise men. And so they undertook a coup against the government of the son of Cyrus. They removed Cambyses, and this man Gamates, with the help of his brother Patizides, ruled precariously over the Persian Empire for 7 months. Yes, just a short 7 months. That's all he had. The way he was able to insinuate himself into the throne was that he claimed to be Smerdis, the brother of Cambyses. So in history he's known as Pseudo-Smerdis. And this revolt of the Magi against the family of Cyrus used a guise. Just the same as back in verse 2, the Samaritans came along in the guise of those who wanted to help. So the Magi, in their attempt to take the throne, used the guise that they were rightful heirs to the throne, claiming to be of the family of Cyrus. Incredible, isn't it? You never get the truth out of the flesh, do you? You never get the truth out of the flesh. It always wears a mask. You and I can be the same, brothers and sisters. It's a sad fact of ecclesial life today that we sometimes wear a mask to the meeting. We don't appear as we really are. I know that to be true. You know it to be true. It's a sad fact. The flesh is a lie. It always wears a mask. We've seen it twice tonight in the one chapter, both in the actions of the Samaritans and in the actions of these people who tried to assume control of the empire. Well, this man, Gamates, was finally removed from power by Darius Hystaspes, who came to power at the end of 522, the beginning of 521. And he ruled for some 36 years thereafter. And the vital year in his reign, as far as we are concerned, is this year, 520 BC. That's when Haggai and Zechariah prophesy in Ezra chapter 5 verse 1. We'll find that out. And the work began again through the prophesying of these two prophets and went on apace for 4 years until the year 516, when the temple was completed in the sixth year of Darius Hystaspes, who we believe was also the husband of Esther. Right, so there's the historic background to what is going on here. Now, the point that needs to be made, brothers and sisters, is simply this. Yahweh provided a friendly ruler in Cyrus and in Cambyses and in Darius Hystaspes for the next 36 years. But for a short period, out of over 50 years, just a short period of 7 months, he permitted on the throne of Persia a man who was opposed to the work of building the house of God. Do you think he could have prevented that? If he could have provided Cyrus, Cambyses and Darius Hystaspes, he could have stopped Gamates. But he didn't. And that's the point. He provided him for a purpose. He provided him to test his people, to test their resolve. And it may just be, brothers and sisters, who knows, that a few months down the track, I don't want to be a prophet, I don't want to be a wet blanket either, but it may just be that down the track, a few months, that the Teetrigully City Council might get a new engineer who hates Christadelphians. May just be. And if it happens that way, then it will be because Yahweh has provided a Gamates to test our resolve. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But if it does, let's be prepared for it, brothers and sisters. I said to you these studies would be practical. We're trying to make them practical for our current situation. If it does happen, let's learn this lesson. What are we going to do? Retire back to our own houses? Decide to sell up and build a bigger and better one? Like these people did, as we'll find out in our next class. What are we going to do, brothers and sisters? We're going to persist with that work in a determined fashion, like David did when he was stopped from building the temple and accumulated the materials for it and laid out the plans and did all the things necessary? Or will we do what these people did? Well, maybe we'll find out. There's the lesson for us. They did exactly that and they justified it. But we'll leave that for our next study, God willing. We'll find out what they did when they left that work and they justified it. Let's just conclude this section with verses 23 and 24 to round it off. I haven't gone into the detail of the verses between verse 7 and 22 because really it's fairly straightforward and you've got the notes. If you desire to do your Bible marking, well then you've got some notes that you can follow. But in verse 23 we read, "Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter, that is the letter of Gamates, the usurper, was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power." The word means arm. By arm, as it is in the margin. And power, kaol. "Then ceased the work of the house of Elah," first of 43 occurrences of the Kaldi term for Eloah, the mighty one. Remember, brothers and sisters, back in chapter 3, And verse 1, at the end of the verse, they gathered themselves together as one mighty man to Jerusalem. They were working on behalf of one described as Eloah, or Elah in the Chaldee, the mighty one. It ceased, that work, for various reasons. First and foremost, because they ceased to work as one man. They were old and young, opposed. Secondly, brothers and sisters, because some did not see the dangers of opposition. Thirdly, because they didn't see the end of the matter. They didn't have a largeness of view. They couldn't see their way through the perplexing problems that overcame them, which were deliberately set upon them. So they ceased working in the house of the Mighty One, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased under the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia, the husband of Esther, specially provided by God, that he might play his part to revive that work. You see, the angels were always there, weren't they? There's the story. The Satan was always there, but the angels were always there, brethren and sisters. It's just that the brethren lost sight of that. They lost sight of it. And they were guilty, from the leaders down to those who might have done nothing else but warm the seat. There's a lesson for us, brethren and sisters. Very simple, extremely simple, but very practical. And what we're going to find is, like most things in life, it's easy to consider these things and to talk about them. It's a different matter when it comes to living and practicing and finding how those things have a practical outworking in our lives.